But first, Erin Lee Carr. She's a documentary filmmaker. Her film, I Love You Now Die, deals with the Michelle Carter murder by texting trial and is now airing on HBO. Erin is also the daughter of the inimitable journalist and best-selling author David Carr. David suffered a fatal collapse in the New York Times newsroom in 2015. He was 58. Erin was shattered by her father's death. She sought solace by going through all of their shared correspondence, almost 2,000 items. Now, Erin has written a memoir about the powerful bond she and her father shared. It's called All That You Leave Behind.
I'm deeply humbled to be David Carr's kid, but I would say that our brains work pretty differently. As I was thinking about writing my book and writing a book that was a lot about my father, our relationship, and sort of the advice he gave me, I thought about structuring it sort of like a film. And I think that something that I always wanted to pay very close attention to is, why is somebody going to read this, and how am I going to keep people engaged? And while my, you know, my dad's book was about 400 pages, that guy had a lot of thoughts, mine is not 400 pages and is really about getting to the point of the story sort of quickly and bringing you on this sort of whiplash, very fast course of what happened. Because I think there might be some eye rolling, oh, a 31-year-old wrote a memoir, wow. No, it's about adulthood, and it's about choices, and it's about, you know, processing things in real time. And who amongst us does not have to do that? So I think it felt really good, and I felt very privileged that Random House gave me the opportunity to write something not 15 years later, but something that really talked about and knocked you out in terms of what grief feels like.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned your and your father's brains work differently. How so?
You know, I don't want to blow smoke up his skirt, but like I think of my dad as a true genius. I've listened to and looked at a lot of his videos, and you know, I'm a constant consumer of media, and he was able to really answer questions in a different way. He was able to pull things out of seemingly out of nowhere. He was able to guide conversations away from the obvious and into the intellectual. It was almost like you were encountering a different language about something you love talking about: media, movies, sobriety, family, honor, humbleness, forgiveness. These are all things we've thought about, but not specifically the way he thought about it.
Very well said. You write in your book that when you were growing up, your dad often whispered to you and your twin sister Megan, everything good started with you. And as you say, you realize that there must have been an everything bad before there was an everything good. So what were the worst things you discovered about your dad from the everything bad period of his life?
Wow, that's a real beaut of a question. What was the worst things I thought of my dad? You know, I think that the book really goes into alcoholism, that it explains everything and excuses nothing. I really had to deal with my father's relapses. And to be clear, he was sober for the majority of my life. I encountered a sober father. But I think there are times when the addiction got a hold of him and he was not able to retain his sobriety. And so interacting with him when that would happen was devastating. It was confusing. It was scary. He didn't know how to communicate about it. I didn't know how to communicate about it. The rest of our family didn't know. But he found his way back to sobriety, for which we all were incredibly grateful.
What would you say was the worst moment in your dad's life when he was looking after you and Megan as a single parent?
I think it was struggling with wanting to get high with having two children. I think that he writes about going to a crack house and bringing us along inside the car and unsure if we were alive when he got back to the car, and knowing that it was not a moment that God would forgive. So I think for him, that was most assuredly a moment of reckoning that he had to deal with. But I really think the financial insecurity that took hold over his life, I mean, he was on welfare when we were little kids. You know, he was destitute, and he was responsible for two kids. And so I think that there are moments of great fear that you remember, like the snowsuits and the car story. But then for years, he was consistently pretty unstable in the financial department, which was, I'm sure, made it impossible to parent in a fully present way. I mean, it was not looking like this was going to end up in a happily ever after, for which I think it did. But I think that is the strength, and that is what sobriety is. It really can change your life in a matter of years.
You say that in order for your relationship with your dad to work, you had to learn not to take his darker moments personally. That's easier said than done. How were you able to manage to do that?
When I think about and I ask people about their relationships with their fathers, there's always this moment of when you realize that your parent is an adult and is struggling to make the next right action. And so when it came to my dad and thinking about sort of the mistakes he had made and his harshness or his intensity, him yelling at me, there's a lot of that in the book.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it was, he's trying to teach me something, but his delivery sucks. And I get a lot of this incredible advice, but this is the cost of admission. Mm. This is how much it costs to deal with this. And dealing with his harshness, I realized, was a part of embracing who he was as a parent. And if I wanted the love to be so great, then I had to deal with sort of the consequences.
Yeah, that makes sense. You were having your own struggles with alcohol. Why were you drinking?
You know, I think people drink because it feels good, and I thought that I am not my parents, that I am not a drug addict. I can probably drink alcohol moderately, and unfortunately, due to my genetic predisposition, that was not correct. I am not able to moderate in any way. So I think that as I started drinking and routinely drank to blackout, it was difficult to realize that my genes had caught up with me and that I was not going to be able to sort of get away with this. There's many people in my family that can drink normally, and I'm not one of them. And so I struggled with that, fighting against that.
Was your dad able to help you deal with your drinking?
He had a unique approach. As somebody who was sober, he used his sobriety to role model behavior, never pushing his own sobriety on me, because that's what they talk about. You can't make someone else get sober. They have to get sober for themselves. So he was able to talk about the gifts that sobriety had given him and maybe hint or infer that I could maybe try to do the same. He did speak to me plainly a couple of times where my drinking got out of control about this is not something that's going to go well for you. I include the sobriety narrative not because I'm proud of it. It's something that's painful and a little embarrassing to talk about, especially in your early 30s. But it also is like, you know, not every alcoholic looks the same. And if we start talking about it, if people are honest about it, then hopefully, you know, we don't have to get till our 80s and still be drinking because it's like, you know, I didn't know that this was a problem. So I think that was some of the goal I set out with the book, to destigmatize alcoholism, that it doesn't need to specifically look like the night of the gun, which is crack, snowsuits, kill your babies in a car almost. It can be like, oh, I'm continuing to make bad choices, and I'm disappointing people around me.
Yeah. You decided you wanted to be just like your dad from the time you were 13, and he was happy to play the part of mentor to your role as mentee. How did you and your father juggle these two relationships of father-daughter and mentor-mentee?
I talk about it in the book that it was difficult because what was more important, being his mentee or being his child?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that he had a lot more interest in mentoring me. You know, by the time I was in my late teens, he's like, you're done. You're parented. You're figured out. You can figure the rest out. I want to help you with your path, figuring this crazy world out. And that was very generous. Like, I think in order to keep the dad-daughter relationship completely clean, he could have not done that. We could have gone sort of separate paths, and I would have had to figure it out. And I think that I really wanted to write very clearly about nepotism, about connections, about advice. I think that when I meet with people or I speak at schools, it's always like, how'd you get here? How are you at 31 and directing your own films? And it's like, I did internships, which I was able to do because University of Wisconsin let me and I could pay for a credit. But it's also because I was connected to someone there. And some people might write me off and say, you know, it's nepotism. That's not a person that I want to learn from because I don't have access. I don't have connections. But what I did in the book very clearly is I wrote the outreach email, and then I showed you what my dad's copy edits were. And so if anybody's reading this book and they're preparing to do this or they've already done this and they want to think about it differently, you look at those emails and, like, you can sort of in a way be mentored by my dad. So I don't know. I think that there's a lot of criticism when it comes to nepotism, And I choose not to hide and be embarrassed by it, but bring it out into the forefront of the conversation and say, okay, well, what can we learn from this? How can I give you those connections? How can I teach you the lessons that I learned from this great human being?
One of the things that really struck me was how your dad was so open with expressing his love and admiration for you. I'm thinking especially of the letter he wrote to you for your 21st birthday, where he wrote, "You are a fundamental joy of my life. Who you are and how you proceed brings me a sense of deep happiness I can't express in words." And then he goes on to express it in words very eloquently. His love and support must have given you a lot of self-confidence, but I'm kind of wondering if you also felt a lot of pressure to live up to his success.
The amount of positive feedback that I got as a young person is borderline unparalleled when I talk to people about this. I interact with a great deal of parents now. A lot of my films are about parenting, about relationships, and it's because it was something that was so foundational to my learning of the world. And I think that, you know, if we ever choose to have children, you or I, or, you know, anybody that's listening to this, just expressing how much you love your kid, but also saying why they're special, what you think about when you think of them. I don't know. I love every second of it. I love reading it now. It emboldens me to know that somebody that I love so much felt that way about me. I think that we could all do with doing some more positive emailing, I guess is my sort of stance on it. I love those emails. I mean, to this day, I read them continuously, thinking that he's speaking to me today and not back then.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, and I can understand why you would. They're just so heartwarming. In your dad's memoir, The Night of the Gun, he wrote about tracking down Kathy. This was a woman who provided daycare for you and Megan years ago. And Kathy told your dad that if he'd had two boys, it would have been different. But because he'd had two girls, it changed him from being self-absorbed to being absorbed in you and your sister, Megan. Do you think Kathy's right?
Absolutely. I mean, Kathy is a true angel sent to us that took care of us. I mean, you know, the narrative of the single dad taking care of two babies is an interesting one. But if you look closely and you read his book, and if you were to ever talk to him, he was surrounded by smart, supportive women. And in my life, I have a stepmom, I have a twin sister, I have a little sister, I went to an all-girls school. I was constantly around women who were as supportive of me as my father was. And he was very careful to include people that he thought were incredible in our lives and not just take full credit for it. And so Kathy was somebody that changed our lives foundationally, teaching us about kindness, about manners, about sharing. I mean, it was a really important part of growing up.
It makes me wonder, could we make the case that you and Megan saved your father's life?
I think we absolutely saved his life. I mean, he was a low-level, very low-functioning drug addict that was at risk for, I think, spending serious time in prison as a result of distribution deals with drugs. I mean, you know, you can be a low-level drug addict, but the second you start dealing drugs, you know, you will be tossed in prison, and there's not a high chance of you getting a job after the fact. So I think that we came at this really unique point in his life where he had to choose between that life, which was getting grim, and the life, the difficult, sober life, which was taking care of us. And we absolutely saved his life. I mean, he said that to us many, many times.
Obviously, you learned a lot from your dad, but is there one thing in particular you can point to as the most important thing that you learned from him?
I mean, I spent, you know, close to 2 years of my life thinking about an answer to that question.
Yeah.
And as we sit here on this day and I think about the answer, for me, it's always been his advice that I think about every day. For me, it's find the smartest people in the room and stick with them. That's who you want on your team. Be a good talker, but be a better listener. You are who you run with, meaning we are the sum total of the five people we spend time with. Kindness matters. Art comes in the space between people. I mean, I'm basically a walking dictionary of David Carr phrases. You know, I literally studied him and the way that he communicated and what he said to me in emails. And I think about him probably every hour of every day, which is, I mean, a little abnormal, but I think that it really helps me as I work on these movies and have this difficult subject matter to think about somebody that has given me advice on it and how to do the next right thing.
Absolutely. It makes total sense to me. What do you think your dad would think of your memoir?
I think he would love it because it's about him. What did he said to me? You are borderline brilliant. So I think that would be his pull quote, borderline brilliant.
He'd have some edits probably, though, right? Do you
Absolutely.
Think? Yeah, for
Without
sure.
Without one doubt.
Yeah. Aaron Lee Carr, thank you very much.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Doug. I appreciate your questions.
Aaron Lee Carr is the author of All That You Leave Behind. She's also the director of the two-part documentary, I Love You, Now Die, airing on HBO. And you can find out more about Aaron on our website, wpr.org/beta.
What makes me laugh is the type of character that's three-dimensional and has a little bit of a sadness to them. Because you're always going to get the laughs at the crazy stuff that you say. You want people to actually buy into the character. That only deepens the humor.
Actor and comedian Mark Brooks talks about his accidental journey from Onalaska, Wisconsin to Hollywood. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio.